are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Today's episode of the Majority Report is sponsored by Secrets, Crimes, and Audio Tape, an audio drama podcast told week after week. This week's audio drama, Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. The Handmaid's Tale takes place in a dystopian future where handmaids are assigned to bear children in a totalitarian theocracy that has overthrown the United States government. This, of course, is completely fantastical. We all know that when the totalitarian theocracy comes, it's not overthrowing the United States government. It's assuming the presidency and then appointed the CIA, Pompeo, all of that. A very cool episode and podcast. You got to check it out if you want to enhance the nightmares that you're already having now, that I'm having. I wake up every morning and I literally, for some reason, the words ghost protocol keep going over my head. Listen to the first couple of episodes today on Secrets, Crimes, and Audio Tape on iTunes, Stitcher, and the Wondery app on Android, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, January 12th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dan Dicker, former floor trader, oil floor trader, author of Oil's Endless Bid, on Rex Tillerson, potentially our next Secretary of State. Meanwhile, Trump's lame no-conflicts plan gets crowded out and crowds out all the other brewing scandals. Question remains, will we see President PP's videos before January 20th?
I like how I randomly get uncomfortable. I finally found the one thing that I'm like, ew.
Is Jeff Sessions a victim in the war on whites?
Well, that's certainly one way of putting it.
Meanwhile, the House passes the RAINS Act en route to make our society more lawless. And the Senate takes a big step in repealing the ACA, and some Dems send pharma a huge, big, wet kiss. Meanwhile, Trump at historic disapproval levels, and he's not even in office yet. Senator Laura Ingraham? She may be trying in Virginia in 18. More Volkswagen employees indicted. And Carson, Pompeo, and Mattis hearings currently ongoing for HUD, CIA, and Secretary of Defense. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. There's a good story in the Times about just how difficult it is to get traction on any one of these stories. Yesterday, we had multiple hearings. Rex Tillerson, day two of Jeff Sessions. We had Homeland Security head hearings yesterday. One or two more. We've got three today, at least. Last night in the Senate, there was a late-night session to basically set up the repeal of the Affordable Care Act via reconciliation. Yesterday, we also had a press conference with Donald Trump, which included him bringing out hundreds of props in the form of manila envelopes or folders that supposedly had documents in there that he had signed that they would not allow reporters to examine because, of course, this was just a fraud.
Reminded me of your Air America story.
Yes. And it basically, if you grew up in New York or you were in New York, I should say, not necessarily grew up, I guess it would depend on when, but in like the mid to late 80s, there were these guys who would go around and they would try and sell you VCRs that were wrapped in saran wrap. And you could just put your hand into the slot. But inevitably, what it was just the outside shell of these things with like some newspapers inside.
I am completely not unconvinced that Donald Trump was somehow involved in that business in the 80s.
Like, I knew like multiple people who had bought, who got like, I got a cheap VCR for $10, and it turned out just to be like a box filled with newspapers. But so Trump gets up there. He comes up with an incredibly lame plan to avoid his conflict of interest. He brings out his tax attorney to argue that this plan is perfect. The tax attorney turns out to have to be a part of a firm that actually won the 2016 Russian Law Firm of the Year Award. I'm not kidding. And
you remember your reaction when you saw that?
I just thought that was just, I thought this has got to be some
it
type
was
of
extraordinary.
Joke. And then Trump went on to refuse to take questions from reporters or specific reporters. We'll play that stuff later. We will also talk about what he said about repealing of the Affordable Care Act. I mean, there's just such a flood of information that, frankly, there's just no way for our society, the way that it's set up in terms of the rapid pace of information, to glom onto any of this. We also had him tweeting out basically a mischaracterization, I mean a lie, about his interaction with Clapper, the head of the DNI, when the National Intelligence Directorate, where Clapper went to him and said, look, we didn't release the 34-page thing. It wasn't a leak because it's a private document. We didn't create the document. We didn't even have exclusive hold on the document. It was sent out by campaigns months ago. So all this stuff is going down. And I'm still not convinced we're not going to see a video in the next 10 days. I mean, we may not.
So this is just traumatic.
Folks, I know that you are feeling like, oh my God, why do I have to be here for this? And you don't. If you're not ready to get back to the daily grind post-holidays, treat yourself to a refreshing tropical getaway at the Pineapple Beach Club in Antigua. Right now, this amazing getaway comes at an even more amazing price because just for $149 per person per night, you can enjoy an adults-only all-inclusive getaway on a white sandy beach. Plus, you get $250 credit resort credit. So you can use that for sailing trips, romantic dining, safari tours, spa services, or gift shop purchases. Get down there, you forget it. You forget your bathing suit, you forget your glasses. Just go to pineapplebeachclub.com to make your reservation today. The resort encompasses 30 acres of tropical foliage, and panoramic vistas. This sounds unbelievable. Five restaurants, three bars and lounges, two freshwater pools, and a spa. I would be spending a lot of time in those bars and lounges and then heading to the beach. Oh, my God.
No spa for you.
I don't think I'm going to be able to take reading this, frankly.
Yeah, this is kind of brutal.
Extend that holiday vacation. Make some time for some well-deserved R&R. Don't wait. This offer expires soon. Go to pineapplebeachclub.com or call 800-772-8711. To book your all-inclusive stay for $149 per night per person, you can enjoy everything I just mentioned and more, and you will get a $250 resort credit. That's pineapplebeachclub.com. See the website for complete details. Meanwhile, we're just about to get, I think, our second Casper mattress.
Oh, you're giving in. Going to make it happen, huh?
Saul is loving his, and now we're all getting jealous. The Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. Supportive memory foam creates an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. You can try Casper. This is the amazing part. For 100 nights, risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. Free shipping and returns to U.S. and Canada. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/majority and using the offer code MAJORITY. Terms and conditions apply. That's $50 off at casper.com/majority and using the offer code MAJORITY. All right, let's play some of this sound, just one of these clips. This is one that we didn't catch yesterday because the camera shot, they did not mic the press yesterday in this press conference. A couple of things about this press conference that you should know. One is that apparently, they filled the room with Trump employees. Remember, all of these press conferences are still happening at Trump Tower. So they filled the room with employees of Trump Inc. That, and so they were clapping and drowning out and booing the press. They did not give the press any microphones, so you couldn't hear their questions. And we didn't see it on split screen. Here is Trump basically crapping all over a CNN reporter, refusing to take his answers, and he will ignore him to go to someone from Breitbart. This is, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how the press reacts to this and if it's going to mean anything. But here is that exchange.
No, Mr. President-elect.
Go ahead.
Mr. President-elect,
go ahead.
Since you are attacking
our news organization. Not you.
Can you give us a chance?
Your organization.
You are attacking
terrible.
Our news organization.
Your organization.
Can you give us a chance to ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir,
quiet.
Can you state,
quiet.
Can, Mr. President-elect.
Go ahead.
Can you state
she's
categorically,
asking a question. Don't
Mr.
be rude.
Mr. President-elect, can you give us a
don't
question?
Don't be rude.
You're attacking us. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can
no,
you
I'm
give
not going to give
question?
You a question. I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you state categorically?
You are fake news.
Now, two things I want you to remember. One is that in the early days of the Obama administration, Fox News was put to the back of the room, essentially, in the press pool. And all of these organizations, particularly CNN, made a big deal about it. Made a big deal about it. You can't do this to a legitimate news organization. I don't think, Shep Smith, I think, came up and said something about this from Fox. But broadly speaking, no. There isn't widespread concern about this. It'll get worse. I guarantee you it'll get worse. And the other thing I want to remind you of, we played this video, I think it was about a month and a half ago. Jeff Bukes was, this he was at a, he was at a, some type of conference. I can't remember what it was. It was the Business Insider's Ignition Conference, I think about a month ago, December 6th. And he was asked a question. He is the CEO of Time Warner. He was asked a question. Are you worried about Trump's attack on the First Amendment? Oh, no, no, no. What I'm really worried about is the Democrats with Citizens United. That's an attack on the First Amendment. Now, understand, this guy's got a $6 billion merger on the line. But this is what we're going to see, folks. This is what we're going to see. We're going to see them lay prostrate. Yeah, maybe Jim Acosta will say, oh, please, Mr. President-elect. But at the end of the day, they're going to take their $6 billion merger as opposed to getting their questions asked. When Bernie Sanders began his race for the presidency It was considered by the political establishment and the media to be a fringe campaign, something not to be taken seriously. But by the time Sanders' campaign came to a close, however, it was clear that Bernie had run one of the most consequential campaigns in modern history. And although his campaign may be over, for Sanders, the political revolution has just begun. Follow along as Bernie Sanders keeps the new administration in check and leads the way toward a progressive future in his new multi-month New York Times bestseller, Our Revolution, A Future to Believe In. You can learn the details of Sanders' historic primary fight and the people who made it possible in Our Revolution, available in hardcover, ebook, and audio, wherever books are sold. It's read by Bernie Sanders and Mark Ruffalo. For more information, visit OurRevolutionBook.com and hashtag ReadTheBurn. Again, it's OurRevolutionBook.com. Pleasure for me to read an ad from Bernie Sanders' organization. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Dan Dicker. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program author of Oil's Endless Bid, Dan Dicker. Hi, Dan. How are you?
Hi, Sam. Okay.
So, Dan, I imagine you have followed Rex Tillerson's career intimately for probably as long as he's been in the upper management of Exxon.
Yeah, and even before that, I mean, I was a Lee Raymond follower in the 80s. I mean, Exxon is the big oil guy in the room, and you gotta mark what they do.
And so, all right, give us a sense from the perspective of an oil trader. I mean, what should we know about Rex Tillerson?
Well, I think what we should know, quite honestly, is that he's an oil man. And when you put an oil man in front of the Secretary of State as the leader of our foreign policy, what you're basically doing is you're advocating for an oil and gas favored foreign policy going through the next 4 years. For me, it's a scary kind of concept. I mean, we're going back in time to a time when, you know, the railroad magnates kind of controlled the U.S. government, the late 19th century and early 20th century here. And they used to be more shrewd about it. Now they're just taking, you know, major CEOs of the number one oil company in the world and just sticking them right in front of our face and saying, hey, there's nothing cagey about this. This is what we're going to do. Exxon has the largest commitment to acreage in Russia that has been denied development rights because of the sanctions that Obama put into place because of the 2014 invasion into Ukraine, and most recently because of the proven meddling in our election. And that is an enormous profit for Exxon that stands to be released with the incoming Secretary of State. I mean, there's nothing even slightly, shrewd about this. This is completely transparent. There's a major connection. There's a reset going on in the relationship, and we've seen it in other ways, but there's a major reset going on between the United States and Russia, and the connective tissue with all of it is oil. And Rex Tillerson is only the most transparent part of that. There's lots of people coming into the Trump administration that show that.
All right. Well, let's start with the most transparent part of it. Now, why would this may sound Pollyannish, but Rex Tillerson he's leaving. He's resigned from Exxon. In fact, he could barely speak about anything that Exxon has done in the testimony yesterday because he's no longer there. Why would he care about the benefit of Exxon? I mean, he's got his he's divested theoretically, and he's no longer the CEO. I mean, explain that to people.
Well, it's not hard to understand. I mean, the man's entire life has been committed to that company. His first job and his last job was at Exxon. He came up through the ranks there, and he landed as a CEO after years and years of coming up the ladder at Exxon. And he is committed to that company in a way that only a career oil guy can be committed to it. So it's really, divested or not. And I think, there's a whole bunch of interesting questions about what stock options he has in trust and what he doesn't and so on, and how he continues to benefit from the profitability of the company going forward. But it's enough to know that he's committed his life to them. And coming into the government after committing your life somewhere, you're going to definitely have a certain bias coming in.
You mentioned the railroad magnates as an example. Now, I can understand how, the rubber meets the road there, or the steel meets the steel in that context, right? I mean, I'm a railroad magnate. I'm going to use the U.S. government to eminent domain or to buy money or to make sure that routes go certain places. I'm going to be able to tell my buddies, like, hey, you might want to buy some real estate here because we're going to put a train stop there. This is going to be where we have a train spread out. How does it translate into having this oil man? Like, how? Obviously, in terms of Exxon getting rid of those sanctions so that Exxon can go on and get involved in this half a trillion dollar deal, that's pretty clear. But how else does it manifest itself?
All right. So if we're talking outside of the foreign policy area, outside of Rex Tillerson, I mean, we look at some of the people who are slated to come into the White House.
Let's start with Rex Tillerson. Like, how, okay, even in the foreign policy arena, like, what are the implications beyond that narrow aspect of that $500 billion deal with Exxon? What are the implications in terms of our relations with Russia, but also in other countries? Like, what is that going to translate into? What is that going to look like in practical terms?
Okay, so the point is that when you walk into a nation, and Rex Tillerson, which is why he's going to be confirmed, has tremendous connections with tons of foreign governments, and he's had to have relationships with tons of foreign governments, because everywhere that Exxon goes, they need to make a deal to somehow use the resources of foreign governments to get oil out of the ground. And it is with that perspective in mind, through that prism, that you can imagine that foreign policy will now be executed here in the United States. It will not be towards, for example, the people that are engaged or the people that are oppressed or people that are having trouble or whatever conflicts are going on in that country. But when Rex Tillerson walks into a country, he's going to go in with the relationship of a foreign nation based upon the economics of oil and the economics of getting oil out of the ground, the economics of leasing a property and of using resources. And to me, that is not that's not the way, and I think it would be to you too, that's not the way to approach foreign policy. But with Rex Tillerson at the helm, this is the way it's going to be approached, with the idea of resource control in mind, with the idea of economic profitability in mind, and not really with the idea of people's human rights in mind. And that, to me, is the greatest crime of putting somebody like this in front of the State Department.
Yeah, what's fascinating is, I mean, I think, maybe I'm a little bit cynical, but I think to a large extent, U.S. foreign policy has all been about resource control around the globe.
Well, let me push back on that. It's been a more diverse resource control, right? So let's talk about that for one second, because this is something, when Bush went into Iraq, a lot of the liberals, and I think you were among them, and Rachel Maddow were screaming, this is all about oil. And in essence, that proved not to be really true, because in the end, all of the oil resources resources remained under the control of the state-run oil companies in Iraq. But you cannot imagine that happening with Rex Tillerson as the head of the State Department in a replay of Iraq. And you've heard Trump, for example, say across the campaign trail a number of times that we should have taken the oil when we were in Iraq. We should have taken the oil when we were in Iraq. And you can imagine that it, now going forward, that if you thought that Bush was running his foreign policy based upon oil, you've got, you know, you're not even beginning to scratch a surface, because with Trump and Rex Tillerson running foreign policy, you can never imagine something like an Iraq conflict without the United States leaving with some sort of major influence on the oil supply. It just won't happen.
Now, all right, let me push back just a little bit on that characterization in terms of Iraq, insofar as that I think my sense was always it was less about actually getting the oil for us and more about having the ability to make sure that we had access to who has access to that spigot, right? It's more, for me, it was more like the metaphor was more like, I want my friends to be standing around the keg so that when I finish my beer, I can just hand it over and have to wait in line.
Well, maybe that was the hope, but that's not the way it worked out. And can say that that's because the Bush administration was somewhat incompetent in all ways that they dealt with Iraq, and that would be fair. But the other thing is that you could never imagine that Rex Tillerson would make that kind of mistake. He won't make that kind of mistake.
Right. And I also imagine that, you know, that his notion of international relations is one-dimensional in that way, in that it is so much about that one particular resource. Who, if that is the case, does he have a sense? I mean, how is he completely agnostic as to, you know, who, you know, I'm just curious as to, I mean, because I've always also speculated that part of that Iraq invasion was that the neocons want to make sure that China did not have access to that oil, ultimately, that was basically their agenda. We just need to make sure that they don't have unfettered access to that oil, maybe not today, but in 30 years. Like, does Tillerson have any type of perspective on all of that, or is it just he just follows the oil?
Yeah, two big points to be made on that, Sam, and I think you hit it on the head on both, and we need to expand on both of them. I mean, you could take a long time expanding on both. Number one, I mean, you could hear it when Tillerson was at his confirmation hearings yesterday, and Rubio talked to him and said, look, do you call this guy a war criminal? Talking about Putin, do you call this guy a war criminal? I mean, he see what he's done in Chechnya, you see what he's done in Aleppo, and Tillerson says, no, I wouldn't characterize him that way. You know, and Rubio kept on pushing, saying, look, what do you need? And he said, well, I need more information. It was a standard kind of political dodge. But the bottom line is that the man is in control of the second largest production of oil and gas in the world. And for Exxon, that's really all that matters. That's number one. The second point you made, which is really interesting and something I've been trying to get my head around for a long time, is yes, you know, I sort of see this reset with Russia, to me, as a commodity guy, as an oil guy, as a resource play, a global resource play that in some way makes a partnership between the Russians and the United States for the express purpose, you are right, of freezing out the Chinese. It's the one thing that over the course of the next 15 or 20 years that the United States and Russia have over the Chinese, because the Chinese right now have all the economic power. And that is scaring the heck out of a lot of Americans. And I think that Trump, you know, give him credit for something. He has this ability to intuit, you know, things that are going to happen in the future and be right about them, even though he may not even know how to express, you know, his intuition in certain ways. And he may be feeling this kind of a resource shortage coming down the road in 5-10 years. And he's positioning himself in terms of making sure that the U.S. is independent, making sure that it can produce as much as possible, throwing climate change and the Paris Accords under the bus, telling, you know, getting in an interior secretary who's going to open up federal lands for drilling as much as he possibly can. You know, to the degree that he can mobilize the power of U.S. resource capability and the power of Russian resource capability and freeze out the Chinese, I think is the really, really, really big forward-looking point that we need to know about, talk about, and understand moving forward, because I think that's where the real point, the real crisis point over the next 4 years, if we get to a crisis point, will be. It will be with the Chinese. And you see, you know, bits of that already, this kind of teaming up with the Russians, freezing out the Chinese, and letting the Chinese know that this is where we're going to, this is where the rubber is really going to meet the road over the course of the next 5 to 10 years. About, it's going to be about resources. It's going to be about copper. It's going to be about oil. It's going to be about gas, iron, zinc. These are the things. Water, land, these are the things that are really going to make the difference. And I'll tell you the truth, when you the more you think about it, the more frightened you get.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. What are the implications for something like the Iran deal? If this is the case, I mean, is it basically, is Tillerson just sit there and he's got a list of like, okay, I got Russia.
You're in, you're out, you're in, you're out.
Yes, yeah, and that's just a function of what's underneath your the ground.
I think you're right. If you're the United States, you're in. You're Russia, you're in. You're Saudi Arabia, you're in. You're Dubai, you're in. The UAE, you're in. You're Israel, you're in. You're Iran, you're out. You're China, you're out. You're India, you're out. You're out, out, out. And I think it's going to come down, you know, if you're Nigeria, you're in. If you're Venezuela, you're out. And these are, you know, based upon resources.
Now, wait, now why
is
it
that simple yes and no things that you're going to find? They're going to be so simplistically put on one side of the fence or the other. I think that's what I see coming. Exactly.
So why are
that.
You out if you're Venezuela and Iran? Because don't you have oil as well?
You do, but you're not playing ball, okay? And if you're not playing ball, and you're not, then you're not part of the team. And if you're not part of the team, you're going to get frozen. Now, if you look at a micro basis, I don't want to make your listeners crazy, but there have been deals going on inside the Iranians who see this coming. They've been making private deals with private traders to make sure that whatever oil production they can do for the next 5 years is already kind of in the pipeline and done with bartering as opposed to money, because they can sense it. There's really going to be this kind of you're in or you're out. It's Russia and the U.S. against everybody, and you boys better get on board or you're going to get left behind. And it's just – it's so strikingly from a corporate point of view and not a humanist point of view, one of the most frightening things – and complicated, but one of the most frightening things I've ever seen in my life.
Why is India out in that list?
Because they're a user. They're a taker. And they've shown and I think they've shown very, very little loyalty on who they'll take from. They'll take from the Iranians. They'll take from anybody as long as they get what they need. And I think in that regard, sometimes the Japanese may have to be a little bit careful under Trump.
Hmm.
Although less so.
This is almost like Walmart coming in and basically saying, like, you guys, we're going to Bigfoot you in this town. We're going to squash the competitors. And in terms of our suppliers, you're going to live or die based upon whether or not you meet our terms.
It feels that way to me, Sam. I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but I'm just, this is what I see. This is what I see. Everybody who's walking into the Trump administration, literally everybody, we could go down the list.
Well, go down that list, because I wonder, right, like, how does, what is the interplay? If this is, I mean, you know, and we can look at guys like Pruitt, right, who's in there at the head of EPA.
That's an obvious one, and, right? This is a climate change denier who's going to be the head of the EPA.
And the co-chair of his reelect campaign, I think in 2014, was Harold Hamm, who is
Harold Hamm is the CEO of Continental. He was supposedly the pick for energy secretary before he said no. And if you don't know, Continental Resources is the largest, actually it's the second largest fracker in the Bakken in North Dakota. And Harold Hamm controls that company. And who did he pick to head up energy? Well, he picked Oops Guy,
right.
You know, Rick Perry. And he's, you know, from Texas, nothing but an oil lover. I mean, we could go down the list. So there's let me see how many more I can just think of off the top of my head. You talked about Pruitt at the EPA. Zinke, who's the Interior Secretary, is a big fan of drilling for coal and oil on public lands. He's the head of the Interior Department.
Huh.
I mean, you get Gary Cohn, who's coming in as the Council of National of Economic Advisors. They talk about him like he's a Goldman Sachs guy, and he is. He's president of Goldman Sachs. But many people don't know that he cut his teeth on the New York Mercantile Exchange, where I was, trading oil. He's an oil guy. The Secretary of the Army coming in is Vinnie Viola. This is the Secretary of the Army. He cut his teeth standing right next to me in the gasoline pits at the New York Mercantile Exchange. He's an oil trader. Carter Page, who's their big guy in Russia, who's part of their economic their foreign policy group in the election. He started. He was in Russia for years working as a consultant at Gazprom and started his own hedge fund called Global Energy Capital. I mean, you can go down the list one after the other of guys who have not small connections, but the head of commerce, Ross,
right.
Wilbur Ross.
Wilbur Ross.
One of his, he runs a hedge fund. One of his largest investments is with Exco Resources. It's a natural gas company in the United States, and it's been a lousy investment for him. He'd love a chance to help make that a winner, as opposed to a loser.
So
Carl Icahn is part, you know, he's right. he's got huge investments in an offshore company called Transocean and with copper mines in Indonesia. I mean, you can't get away from it. It's all resources everywhere you look.
And so what is the relationship between opening up all the lands? I mean, actually drilling more in this country. What is the relationship between that and the potential glut that it produces with our international relations? I mean, how, you know, because it seems, I mean, to someone like me who's not as well educated about this at all, it seems like those are, there's a little bit of tension there, right? I mean, if we're going to keep producing extraordinary amounts of oil domestically, how does that implicate our relations with Russia or with Saudi Arabia, whatnot?
Okay, well, look, from my perspective and from most oil analysts' perspective, well, I wouldn't say most, but here's the point. This has been an outlier the last 2 years. Low energy prices, low natural resource prices, low copper prices has been a real outlier. In general, since the turn of the century, we've been seeing a steady rise in the costs of natural resources. And most people, me particularly, but most people think that this has just been a bump in the road caused by various other financial factors and what has been a short-term overproduction, particularly in oil and gas here in the United States. But that fundamentally not only will change, but if you gave me an hour, I could explain to you why it has to change. So prices that you're seeing now for gasoline, oil, natural gas, coal, even copper for sure, zinc, iron, all of these things, they're unnaturally low. And over the course of the next 4 or 5 years, you know, in my view, triple, all of them, triple. And, you know, again, if you had an hour, I could prove that to you. Now, most analysts don't go there because they can't go there. They have an obligation to investors not to be wrong, so they can't make wild predictions. But if you talk to people who are inside, they know that these prices are unsustainable. They know that they're headed up. The only question is how fast and how far.
Wow.
So that's really where we are. We have a group of people inside the White House, coming into the White House, who understand that fundamental fact that the prices that we're staring at for oil, gas, and other resources are unnaturally low, and they won't stay that way. So
they're basically using our government as a huge buying opportunity.
Yeah, it's look. This is a corporatocracy we're building here. this is, you know, if you thought, you know, what's good for General Motors is good for the country. I'm working on a long form piece, which I hope will be picked up by somebody, but it's called the Exxon presidency. I mean, this is what this is going to be about. It's not going to be talked about. They'll talk, you know, like you say, they'll talk about the pee-pee jokes or whatever. And they'll talk about what, you know, whatever mistakes, you know, of Ivanka, you know, had when she was whatever.
But right.
This is these are the big, big issues that will affect us and affect the world globally over the course of the next 4 years of Trump. It's about this damage, this impossible to turn back damage that will be done by this singular mobilization of resources.
And so,
U.S. resources.
I mean, give me a sense of what the foreign relationship, the foreign relations landscape looks like. Then are we then basically just empowering oligarchs in other countries? I mean, almost as like as an unstated, obvious, I guess, side effect, or maybe that's not a side effect. Maybe that's not a pleasant bug. That's actually a specific feature. But right, I mean, it's because it's oligarchs who control all of these resources, and increasingly so, probably here, corporate oligarchs. But in all these other countries, we're talking about enriching a few global elite, and everybody. It's almost like everybody's just getting together for their sort of a rolling Davos.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think you would have had different outcomes or different courses of action in Libya, in Egypt, in Yemen, in Nigeria, and all of these in Syria, all of these flare-up points that have some sort of inflection point with oil somewhere. Would have been different under a Trump presidency than an Obama one. And moving forward, the new dust-ups that occur, because nothing's ever quiet for long, will have the progress there and the United States' role and influence in those dust-ups will be monumentally different based upon those inflection points of oil. That's what I believe is going to happen. And that's, again... It won't hinge upon people who are being who are under control of oligarchs or are being slaughtered or are being oppressed or are otherwise being economically denied. It will be much more based upon our foreign policy, will be much more based upon the resources contained in that country. And how they will impact the United States economy and the global economy and the profitability of companies just like Exxon. And that's where we are, Sam.
This might be outside your portfolio a little bit, but is that going to be inherently destabilizing? I mean, if you are, if you're only having that one sort of northern star to guide what you're doing, it seems to me that you're going to be missing a lot of this other stuff that's happening.
I think destabilizing it won't be. I mean, sometimes, you know, if we could argue, and you're right, it's slightly outside my view, but we could argue that Iraq was quieter under Saddam Hussein, right?
Mm-hmm.
We could argue that Egypt was quieter.
So in some respects, this may keep us out of more conflicts because... all we care about is wealth extraction in some fashion, and we can make a deal.
Yeah, but it makes us less human.
Right. I mean, at the expense of maybe another of other people. And
Yeah. I think that's exactly right.
Where should we be looking? I mean, if there were countries to be looking at to say, like, what's going on there? Obviously, Russia seems to be top of the list in terms of, like, a reorientation. Where else?
Iran, for sure. I think you'll see a turnaround in some of the nations of Africa, which will go under the radar because not many people know about the foreign relationships that we have in Africa, but they're going to come to the fore because there's oil resources there. And very much the oil companies have been on their own in terms of dealing with foreign governments there. Iraq for sure. I mean, I take Trump at his word in a lot of things that he says. And when he talks about regaining a certain amount of influence in Iraq over oil resources, I think he means business. And to the degree that Tillerson can make that happen, and he can to a very large degree, he knows everybody there, he's going to make that happen. And past that, here in the United States, you'll see movement again towards drilling in the Arctic. You'll see movement again towards the increase of infrastructure building, pipelines. Keystone will come back. I'm telling you, Keystone will be back, even though nobody wants it anymore. Even though it's nobody wants it built anymore, it'll be back. I think those are the spots, you know, to be looking at from a foreign policy point of view. Where things dust up, where things have issue, no one can say where they're going to come forward. But I tell you, if you keep this in mind, if you keep that idea of resources, natural resources, control of natural resources, influence into natural resources, and the inflection point of oil in the front of your mind, you'll get a really good sense of what's going to happen. It won't be hard to see.
Lastly, what about Europe? I mean, what about a place that, you know, like...
I mean, the Europeans are on their own. Hasn't Trump made that clear? They're on their own. You got to take care of your own defense. You got to take care of your own economy. Brexit is good. You know, this is...
Because they're just customers.
Exactly. They've got their... You know, as far as we're concerned, you're on your own. You're on your own. We're moving in a different place. The world has changed. This is no longer the post-World War II collective of Western nations against Eastern nations. This is about those with resources and those without. And I think that's really the way Trump is going to reorder the world. That's what we're looking at.
Dan Dicker, author of Oil's Endless Bid, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Sam.
All right, folks.
Everyone should read
that Skype sound. Never more appropriate. Bing, bing. Bye-bye.
Goodbye, modern order. I could put a link on the website, but a couple weeks ago, Germany's former foreign minister wrote a column called Goodbye to the West, by which he meant the modern security architecture. Mm. And it's exactly what Dicker's talking about. And I also wonder, because there's this history that kind of becomes more interesting now because of what's happening. But the last German government before Merkel, the chancellor, Gerhard Schroeder, like days after he left office, joined, I think it was Gazprom, on the board of directors and became a lobbyist for the Nord Stream, which is another Russian pipeline project. And then his foreign minister, who wrote the piece, lobbied for something called the Nabucco pipeline, which would have piped through like the stands, Azerbaijan, I think, into Europe as an alternative from Russia. So that seemed like this obscure like Euro debate in like 2011, 2010. And now it's like, yeah, that's actually pretty fundamental. Nabucco didn't work. And I wonder if there's going to be some rethinking of maybe we need to seriously construct that pipeline for real. But I'll post that link. And he's talking about like that he thinks of it in exactly the same terms, that this is just like mutual security is done. And we're just doing resource conflict. And what Europe needs to do is basically just try to not piss Russia or China or us off, essentially. That's kind of the move they have, is just to use their purchasing power to not annoy people.
Well, there you have it, folks. Happy Thursday. It's always good to get his perspective, because it's not a perspective that you hear much, right? Like people who, I think I mentioned that I spoke to Wendell Potter on Ring of Fire for this week about, particularly about how the insurance industry is looking at what's going on with the repeal and replace, or the repeal and pretend to replace, or the pretend to repeal and sort of change the name.
And slightly worse new name.
Wendell Potter used to be an insurance executive. And, you know, one of the questions I asked him was, why are we not seeing the insurance industry freaking out right now? We're not seeing it in their stock prices. We're just not seeing a freak out. And he was like, well, they don't care if they're not in the individual, broadly speaking. So they don't care if they're not in the individual insurance market. The profits there are, for most of them, not that big. And there's risk there. Said in the group insurance business, where they basically, you know, are talking about large scale employers, said that it's not even their money. They're just paid to be servicers. And they're just, it's just a fee for them. And that's where they make their big cash. There's no money on the line. You know, all these major companies that are self-insured, essentially, they farm out the servicing to somewhere else. So he's like, you know, the one thing that they really would like is some type of like clarity. So there you have that. Boy, oh boy. Let's just do a couple more clips of Tillerson so that we can put Rex Tillerson to bed. Now, it is possible, right, that Tillerson does not get voted, is not approved in committee. I think
he might be the only one that might get shot down. I can't believe Sessions is going to get confirmed, but whatever.
Exactly.
That seems obvious that he is, but that's unbelievable.
But I think it's Republicans have one more person on the Foreign Relations Committee than the Democrats. The nomination would still, I believe, go to the floor. They'd still get it to the floor, and then it remained. But if he loses in committee, but here is, just to give you a sense of, you know, Dan Dicker's perspective is that Tillerson is just going to function. And again, I'm a little more cynical than he is. I think to a large extent, foreign policy, at least historically for this country, has been largely about resource extraction or control of resources, or a, you know, at best, a geopolitical perspective that is played out largely dictated by resources. I think there are obviously exceptions to that. There are, you know, added security features and notion of like humanitarian concerns. I don't want to get too carried away, but also, you know, legacy issues.
Isn't it? It's like when people say that the United States, in many respects, operates like a kleptocracy. That's true, but there's an operative word there, which is like.
Right.
We're heading
right
into the next phase.
Right. If American foreign policy has been somewhere between 50% to 80% about resource control and extraction and whatnot, you still have that 20%. Or, you know, anywhere from 20 to 50% at any given
which
time.
Which may be significant when some of that 20% goes to support a opposition NGO in Cairo and that funding is going to go.
Right. Right. Or even just an attempt to create Middle East peace at different stages along the way. Or an idea of sending an emissary to the Congo to stop a war. Or, you know, it is about where you're willing to expend your own resources as a State Department.
Charles Taylor got diamonds out of the ground just fine. What's the problem?
Right. I mean, you know, for instance, like, you know, just off the top of my head, you know, Russ Feingold gets sent to Central
Congo,
Africa to stop a war. I think the point that we're hearing with a Rex Tillerson is like, what? that's so far down the list. Like, you know, that's way below repainting the lobby.
So wait, we're sending a Jew to a lake part of Africa?
I just don't think
it's
none of the people working on those things. And you got to remember, these are huge operations, right? State Department is a massive, massive bureaucracy, largely filled with people who have dedicated their lives to trying to make the world better. civil servants who have a genuine concern about trying to use American power to help people around the world. I think largely that's what like the State Department is staffed at. How it's led at any given point, and then they have their own personal negotiations amongst themselves internally and with other people working there as to, you know, how much good can I do when I know that some of what we're doing is, you know, not what I would consider good. But the sense that we get with a guy like Tillerson is that that's out the window. We have one prime directive, and everything must be funneled through that prime directive. And here is Tim Kaine, I think, like, he's actually asking about climate science, but I think Tillerson's response, ultimately, where he's like, basically saying, like, dude, I'm not going to answer you. I don't give a shit that you're part of the Senate. That's not what I'm here for. I think is indicative of the way of just how single-minded he will be. Here is Tim Kaine asking Rex Tillerson about the question of climate science and the revelations that have come out over the recent months that Exxon has known for decades that climate change was going to be a problem. Their own scientists had found this, and Exxon hid this information and hid it not just from the public, but also they had a fiduciary responsibility to tell their shareholders. Because if the planet starts to burn, it's possible that governments may react to it and undercut their business model. But here is Tim Kaine asking Rex Tillerson about that.
There's been a great deal of coverage about ExxonMobil's history with the issue of climate change. There was a recent two-part article, review of books, prepared by members of the Rockefeller Family Foundation and investigated by an independent team for the Columbia School of Journalism. In 2015, there was a three-part series in the Los Angeles Times, and in the same year, Inside Climate News did an eight-month investigation and produced a nine-part series that was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize, all on the question of ExxonMobil's knowledge of basic climate science. These articles conclude the following, and then I'm going to ask you some questions. One, ExxonMobil concluded as early as the 1970s that pollution from CO2 released by the burning of fossil fuels was affecting the climate in potentially destructive ways. Two, despite this knowledge, ExxonMobil took public positions against the scientific consensus regarding climate science. Three, ExxonMobil funded outside organizations that publicly denied, downplayed, and obscured the scientific consensus. And four, ExxonMobil, despite claims to the contrary, continues to provide funding, if at a lower level, to outside groups that deny, downplay, or obscure the scientific consensus. Are these conclusions about ExxonMobil's history of promoting and funding climate science denial, despite its internal awareness of the reality of climate change, during your tenure with the company, true or false?
Senator, since I'm no longer with ExxonMobil, I'm in no position to speak on their behalf. The question would have to be put to them.
I'm not asking you to speak on ExxonMobil's behalf. You were with the company for nearly 42 years?
That is correct.
And for the majority of your time, you were with the company in an executive and management position?
Approximately half the time.
And you became CEO in 2006?
Correct.
So I'm not asking you on behalf of ExxonMobil. You've resigned from ExxonMobil. I'm asking you whether those allegations about ExxonMobil's knowledge of climate science and decision to fund and promote a view contrary to its awareness of the science, whether those allegations are true or false.
The question would be have to be put to ExxonMobil.
And let me ask you, do you lack the knowledge to answer my question, or are you refusing to answer my question?
A little of both.
I have a hard time believing you lack the knowledge to answer my question, but that's an editorial comment, just like your comment was an editorial comment. With respect, refusing to answer my question.
I don't know. I guess if I was Tim Kaine and I had a witness say something like that to me, I would be a little bit more angry. Maybe that's because I have anger issues. But
well, those aren't mutually. You might have anger issues, and his response was
would be angering,
a bit tepid,
but, right? But I think you get a sense of how civic-minded Rex Tillerson is in that, right? Like, A, broadly speaking, I don't give a shit about the fact that we knew and we lied about this for decades. And B, I don't give a shit that you're asking me, and as a senator, and I'm obligated to answer your questions. So it gives you a sense of how single-minded Rex Tillerson's going to be and how civic-minded he will be. Here is Marco Rubio, who was a surprisingly... well, I don't know if people contemplate that Marco Rubio would be putting on such a show. Now, Marco Rubio is a huge showboat, right? Like, we learned this with immigration reform. People forget, but he made a huge deal about how he was going to lead the Republicans in immigration reform. And then he realized at one point, like, oh, no, I've got to do a full retreat on this because I'm going to run for president. So it's more than likely he's just putting a show on here for some of his neocon buddies who may have an issue with Russia and don't have the same investment in oil that the rest of the Trump administration has. But here is Marco Rubio questioning Tillerson about whether or not he believes Putin is responsible for numerous deaths of members of the media.
In fact, I want to enter two things into the record, Mr. Chairman, without objection.
Without objection.
The first is a partial list of political dissidents, journalists, and critics of Vladimir Putin who were suspiciously murdered or died under highly suspicious circumstances. The second thing I want to enter into the record is a letter addressed to this committee by Vladimir Karamurza, who himself was mysteriously poisoned and is an opponent of the Putin regime. I'd like to enter that into the record.
Without objection.
Mr. Tillerson, do you believe that Vladimir Putin and his cronies are responsible for ordering the murder of countless dissidents, journalists, and political opponents?
I do not have sufficient information to make that claim.
Are you aware that people who oppose Vladimir Putin wind up dead all over the world, poisoned, shot in the back of the head? And do you think that was coincidental, or do you think that it is quite possible, or likely, as I believe, that they were part of an effort to murder his political opponents?
Well, people who speak up for freedom in regimes that are repressive are often at threat, and these things happen to them. In terms of assigning specific responsibilities, I would have to have more information. You know, as I indicated, I feel it's important that in advising the president, if confirmed, that I deal with facts, that I deal with sufficient information, which means having access to all information. And I'm sure there's a large body of information that I've never seen that's in the classified realm. I look forward, if confirmed, to becoming fully informed. But I am not willing to make conclusions on what is only publicly available or have been publicly reported.
None of this is classified, Mr. Tillerson. These people are dead. Political opponents are
your
dead.
Your question was people who were directly responsible for that. I'm not disputing these people are dead.
Senator Menendez.
There's Tillerson dispensing with Rubio. There it is. I mean, the real question is going to be, will Rubio vote for him or against him? Tillerson may be one of the few guys who is in jeopardy in this administration. We will see. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Oh, should we do the Ben Carson? We'll do the Ben Carson in the fun half. That's a fun one.
Except it's not, but yes.
Well, I think, you know.
No, it's fun. It's fun.
It's fun.
Inadvertently and revealing.
We'll also play a couple of clips from Trump's press conference yesterday. Buckle in, folks. I mean, I get the sense there's going to be a lot of this, of this just insanity. And the challenge is going to be to both pace ourselves so that we don't all, you know, sort of become exhausted, but also not to numb ourselves to how off the rails this really is. I mean, we have a president now who, or in 10 days we will. Right now, I guess he's president electoral. And in 10 days, to be fair, 15 days, or 8 days, he will still be president electoral. But he is now the president electoral elect. Then he will just be the regular president electoral. Who is bragging about the $2 billion deal that he could have made this weekend. Talking about how he promises he's not going to profit off this. His sons are going to take care of the business. And aside from just the that part of the kleptocracy, we also have... did you not get that Rudy Giuliani on Fox and Friends? I was in that list of he's now going to be head of some type of special cybersecurity group. Yes. I mean, all the friends are they're all going to get rich, folks. And that's the
except for Chris Christie.
Except for Chris Christie. That's the that's not the worst part about it. It's all the implications on all of this that is going to be somewhat problematic. All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. Take your phone calls. Don't forget, you can become a member of this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. And let me remind you, if you are having any financial issues whatsoever and you either want to continue your membership or need help in joining, send us an email at Majority Reporters, even if we're late in responding. And if we haven't responded after, let's say, a week, because I sometimes get behind, send an email in again and just bear with us. We will work something out with you. If we haven't responded, it's just because we're behind on emails. But we don't want anyone to be shut out for financial reasons, and we certainly don't want anybody to be, for the show to be a financial stress on anybody. That's really important. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. If you use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off of your coffee, get the Majority Report blend. You can get other blends. I'm not going to name them, but you can get them. Also, leave us a review on iTunes. It helps. And if you want to give a gift to somebody, do it at Majority Gift. And remember, although his campaign may be over, for Bernie Sanders, the political revolution has just begun. Follow along as Sanders spins lessons about what really matters in life, according to the Washington Post, in his multi-month New York Times bestseller, Our Revolution, A Future to Believe In. For more information, visit OurRevolutionBook.com and hashtag ReadTheBurn. Again, that's OurRevolutionBook.com. Be right back. Hey.